You have lots of traveling by plane. Quite often the captain warns the passengers that they are about to enter a stormy area and the ride will be bumpy. I'm afraid we are entering a stormy area tonight and the ride will be very bumpy, particularly in the middle. It will be very, very difficult analysis, epistemological analysis. At the end, we will have smooth sailing. But in the middle, we will have a very precise epistemological analysis. And I would recommend that the audience give its full attention. Anyway, told us Hashemayim v'Oretz v'Yiborom v'Yim Asot Hadeshem Elikim Eretz v'Shamayim. This text lends itself to a double interpretation. We can translate the sentence Anyway, told us Hashemayim v'Oretz v'Yiborom. These are the creations or the productions of heaven and earth. The term kodesh refers to the various creations about which the Bible speaks in chapter 1, and which here are categorized under two classes: heaven and earth. In other words, Rashi says that Elatendes means this is the story of creation. Rashi states explicitly, in other words, according to Rashi, the verse Eilei Tolles Hashamayim V'Oretz is to be considered as the last part of the previous chapter. I would say the concluding sentence of the previous chapter. Those are the events, that means the events or the creations which occurred during the 6 days, and which were already recorded in the first chapter, that led to the creation of the universe, which is called Shamayim Eretz. On the day that Almighty God made heaven and earth. This is the way Rashi interprets. Hirsch already noted that as far as biblical semantics is concerned, the term Tolles always refers to a story which has not yet been told, rather than to something which is known already. To results, it refers to results, not to causes. To developments, not to the origin. Usually the term Tolles has the connotation of offspring, generations a person had begotten, rather than ancestry. If we should accept Hirsch's suggestion, then the verse Eilei Tolles Hashamayim v'Oretz v'Yiborom will have to be translated in the following fashion. These are the developments of heaven and earth after they had been created. Not the way Rashi interprets the event which led to the emergence of the universe, but that is the story of the universe after the latter had been created. What the noise here? The verse in this context is not to be taken as the conclusion of the story of creation, which was recorded in the first chapter, but as the beginning of the new story the Bible is about to tell in the second chapter. Eile told that Hashemayim Voretz Bivorom, those are the developments or the results of the generations. I don't care about term, you use various translations, use a variety of terms, but though this is the story of the universe after it had been created, not before it had been created. These are the generations, productions, or developments. Who are those? I mean, to whom is the, to what developments does the Bible refer? If Tevis is related not to the previous chapter, but to the following chapter, to the second chapter, to whom does the Bible refer? Tovot HaShemayim V'Aretz V'Chol Tzvarom? Yes? Men, but the Torah immediately begins to tell the story of men. Namely, Adam and Eve, for whose sake the world was created. In other words, the Torah tells us that the purpose of creation is to be found in man. If we should ask the question, why did the Torah tell us the story of the emergence of the universe? After all, the Ramban already noticed it's a mysterious, it's an enigmatic story, and a fragmentary story. Why did the Torah tell us that story? The answer is that the story was told in order to make it possible for the Torah to tell us another story in which the Torah was interested, in which the Bible was concerned. Namely, what story? The story of man. Not the story of heaven and earth. Not the story of the astral world. Not the story of emergence of organic life. The theory, that's just the introduction, the prelude to a more exciting story. Namely, the story of man. His growth, his development, his victories and defeats, his wise as well as absurd decisions and deeds. The Torah was, at the beginning of the second chapter, the Bible was through with the narrative concerning the emergence of the physical universe and began to focus attention upon the Toldot, upon man, the objective of creation. And dramatically, of course, we study Chumash not paying attention to the charm which the word exuded. Dramatically, the Torah portrays the dreariness and the desolation of a world without man, even though everything was created. And the Torah begins to tell us in simple words, but very meaningful words. The earth was barren and uncultivated, since there was no man to till the ground. And apparently the Torah is of the opinion that man is indispensable in this world. Not so much to till the ground. If you know the Rashi, Vodom Ayin Avedes Adomo, you realize that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Almighty, was in need of man, actually, if I may say so, not in order to cultivate the ground. The ground could have yielded its produce without man's intervention. if I could go who had wanted it, but mainly to pray for rain. Apparently nature minus man is an absurdity. And apparently the God and hearkens to his joyous son when he is victorious, as well as to his shrill wail of despair when he meets with disaster. Man was missing, not a working man, but praying man. Nakadosh Baruch Hu wanted was lonesome for man, for praying man, to engage men in the conversation. Only with the arrival of man, God began to give rain and show his concern for the world. Within this frame of reference, we understand why the Torah deemed it necessary to repeat the story of creation, you know, in the second chapter of creation of man, excuse me. In the second chapter, the Torah repeats the story of creation of man. Why was it necessary? You know what the Bible critics had made of it, of that repetition, without paying attention to the eidetic content of the two stories. The Torah had to retell the story of man. In order to reveal to us a new aspect of man, which is indispensable, that new aspect is indispensable for the understanding of his paradoxical history, or the paradoxical history of man, which the Torah is ready, the Bible is ready to start telling us. In the first chapter, the Torah narrated about origin of man, but within the context of cosmic scheme of things, within the context of the cosmic drama. There man appeared as the final phase of the process of emergence of the physical universe. The Bible did mention, of course, in the first account, that man was created in the image of God, and that he was charged by his Maker with the task to control and rule his environment. Certainly, the Torah did it, but nevertheless, the position of man within the drama of universal creation, as told to us in the first chapter, is rather a peripheral one, not a central one. 5.5 days were assigned to the making of the physical world, and only one half of the sixth day of Friday, to the formation of man. The story in the first chapter is far from suggesting to us, very far from suggesting to us anthropocentric teleology that man is the purpose of the world. In the first chapter we just read that man is a creature within the cosmic world order. Yes, the first chapter emphasizes that man is capable, man is skilled, man is wise. Nevertheless, he is only a creature. And in order that man be placed in the center of the cosmic drama, he would have to do better, to be more than a creature, to cast off his creatureliness. the second chapter, the Torah moves man from the circumference to the focus by telling us that man is the objective of creation, and that as long as man was absent from this world, God did not cause it to rain and have vegetation grow and develop. The Torah, having stated man's centrality in the second chapter, engages immediately in the narration of events and begins to tell us what happened to man, opportunities which were offered to him, is about his rebellion and ingratitude, his punishment and despair, the blessings that were bestowed upon him, and the cares with which he was buried. In a word, the Torah tells us a strange story of man, with all its curves and zigzag lines, its man's regressive movements and forward surges. Man appears here in a new role, namely, not as a cosmic being, on the periphery of the biblical narrative about the emergence of the cosmos, but as a history-making being, right in the center of the narrative. The new declaration of man was formulated in the second chapter. Yitzer Hashem Elokim Adam min Adamo, Vayipa Be'apov Nishmas Ruach Chaim, Vayio Adam Lenefesh Chayo, particularly with the emphasis placed by the Onkelos, Leruach Memalalo, to a spirit who was endowed with speech. The declaration of man as a singular, precious, non-recurrent historical being requested the retelling of the story of his origin in order to explain the paradoxality and unevenness of his historical performance. To the question, why did man betray his maker at certain times, while on other occasions he acted with gallantry and courage? Why did he, in many instances, violate basic principles, while he manifested honesty and abiding loyalty in other instances? Why the strange twists of the road along which the historical being has been traveling? As a cosmic being, there is no answer. The way he was portrayed in the first chapter, man should have acted uniformly, consistently, reasonably, with simplicity. He should have marched on straightforward, without retreating from heights conquered, and without surrendering points of vantage seized at high price, at high cost. Why does man act erratically? The Bible, in retelling the story of creation, of his not cosmic man, but historical man, gave the answer to all those questions. The story of cosmic man, as portrayed in the first chapter, did not suffice. And that's what the Bible had to retell. The second chapter is the answer to the question of why man is a paradoxical being, a strange being. What is the answer? No. What is indeed the answer? Now let me ask you, what is indeed the answer in the second chapter? Of course, you might dislike what I'll tell you, because here, as far as the answer in the second chapter is concerned, I change my roles. I'll become a magic. But I believe the answer is given in the second chapter. At least that's the way Chazal understood. And Rashi as well. What do you say about it? What do you pardon? What? What's that? No. If I say the second chapter means in the, right at the beginning, right, Tzav appears much later. I believe the latter, and please I want you to listen carefully, because we are moving toward the stormy area. I believe the latter is implied in one word. Perhaps what I tell you now is homiletics, not philosophy. But it doesn't matter, the idea is correct. The answer is implicit in one word, in the Vayitzer. Why is Vayitzer so strange? I mean, I don't know. I mean, whoever knows Rashi. Yeah. The two U's. Contrary to the ordinary spellings, orthography, the Vayitzer contains two U's. What does the additional yud stand for? That's what our sages have asked. Rashi quoted. The reply that Chazal gave, which was quoted by Rashi, is as follows. The additional letter symbolizes duality. Man is a dual being. Shtei yitziras b'adam. Yitziro leilam hazeh v'yitziro l'tchiyat ha'midim. Man, in other words, man is a dual being. Please pay attention. Two souls abide in him. Two souls, I emphasize, souls. Two souls abide in him. The Almighty, let men share in a double existential experience. Two personae accompany him like two ever-trailing shadows, each one offering man identity and the sense of belonging. Man actually has one problem, with which image he should identify himself. Whose offer he should accept and whose offer he should reject. This is the problem with which man is confronted, was confronted at the dawn of creation, he is still confronted in modern times, in our generation. Man quite often, as a matter of fact, is totally perplexed, not knowing with whom to identify himself, and to whom to pledge allegiance. This ontological duality, it's ontological, it's the existential experience, is a dual one. And I'm saying, it will be translated, I'll translate later into psychological terms, how the duality asserts itself in psychological terms. But basically, it's ontological duality, an existential metaphysical duality. It's not psychological, the very beginning. The origin of that duality which splits man is metaphysical, ontological. This ontological duality continues throughout generations with inexplicable tenacity to haunt all human aspirations and all human decisions and actions. That is the reason, in short, for man's clumsy and cumbersome performance in history. Well, let me say that, and it's not chauvinism, it is true. Jihadans, who was the first one to discover the double creation of man, or man's duality, or his twofold ontology. It was formulated not only in Vayitzeh, but in many passages of our Bible. I know that somebody in that audience, I don't know, I mean, that audience, may raise a relevant question and argue with me that Judaism is not the first one and not the only one which was aware of a split, of a schism in man, or of a dual existence in man, or a twofold existential experience in man. You will say, rightly so perhaps, you point out the fact that both the Greek philosophy, particularly in its classical tradition, since Socrates and Plato, as well as the Christian theologians, have known about the schism in man, about the split man, or the way theologians say, the way theologians call that split, the inner contradiction in man. And that duality is known in Western civilization since the time of Plato and Socrates and Plato, who spoke of the disharmony man, of the conflict between body and soul, between nous and soma. And of course, the critic who will argue with me will say that in Christian theology it is certain that theologians were aware of the split man, of the duality, that being, and on the contrary, that inner contradictions in man, the inner contradiction in man, the schism in man, has become the cornerstone of Christian theological anthropology. As a matter of fact, a little reading of Plato's scriptures, of Plato's books, particularly Phaedrus and Phaedon, and a little reading of Augustine would suffice, I mean, to confirm the objection which the critic would raise. But I believe that the refutation of this argument is as follows. I still insist that Jihadus was the only one, not only the first one, but the only one. There are two basic differences between Judaic anthropology and that of the classical Hellenistic tradition or Christian theology. Greek philosophy, as well as Christian theology, spoke of the division in man into body and soul. The duality consists in man comprising man consisting of body, a physical reality, and soul, a spiritual reality. Judaism says, no, that is not the duality to which the Bible refers, not body and soul. The duality consists in two souls abiding in the human being. The schism, according to Jihadus, is not that of flesh and spirit, which is so common in Christian theology, and even in Plato, but of two existential experiences within the spiritual dimension of man. This is the first distinction in the classical concept of human duality and Judaic approach. Second, there is another principle. Of course, it follows from the first argument. Greek classical philosophy, as well as Christian theology, consider the duality man a curse, a result of sin. The happy state of man, the ideal state of man, would express itself, on the contrary, in existential monism, in unity. Only when man committed original sin and the fall of man took place, suddenly an inner contradiction developed within man. And hence, man is supposed somehow to reject the body and accept the spirit, and in so doing, he'll simply be saved from duality which haunts him. You know very well, people may have a funny notion of the Greek philosophy. You know very well that Plato and Phaedon, as also as in Phaedrus, speaks of death as an act of liberation of the nous and the intellect, the spirit, from the valley of shadows, the neon of the poet. And as an ascent, death is an ascent into the world of ideas, if you call it ontason. And the Christians certainly spoke of contemptuous, indeed, odium mundi or sepulchre. You have the contempt of the world and the physical world, or even the hatred of the physical world. Of course, as I said before, the theologians were of the opinion that duality in man is a result of sin. Adam, before the fall, was a monistic creature and enjoyed full unity. Therefore, in the opinion of those theologians, the ideal state is that of monistic existence. Jihadus, as I tried to explain before, did not recognize at all the chasm dividing body from soul. The duality consists, in opinion of Jihadus, not in that of physical body and spirit, but within man's spiritual dimension. Man's spiritual awareness is a twofold one. The very image of man contains a schism, the spiritual image of man. And that schism, or that duality, was stamped by the creative hand of God, immense very awareness, and until this day rules human nature to its most intimate and remote recesses. The ramifications of human duality are enormous. Only within that framework does Jihadus look with the inquiring eye upon the human historical drama, replete with surprises and paradoxes. Because the hero of the drama is a dual being. I don't mean hypocrite, but a dual being. And Jihadus accepted the duality of man, because God willed man to be dual being at creation. It's not something which man came across later by sinning. God willed it, and God stamped the duality in man's nature. Now the problem is, this is the main problem, and now actually The stormy area, I mean, we are entering the stormy area, and I would advise you to fasten your belt. Let us analyze the human dual ontological awareness. That part will be difficult. Later, I'll have smooth sailing. How does this duality assert itself? Since the latter, I mean the duality, is not to be identified with the body-soul conflict, but runs through the whole gamut of the human spiritual personality. What is it? Simply, what is it? In order to understand that, I have to introduce a passage from the Rambam. It's a very difficult passage. I'm not going to analyze completely that passage. It will take up so much time. But one idea, one motive I have to isolate from that passage. Because without it, we would not understand human duality, what it consists, and how it asserts itself. I'll read it in Hebrew, and I'll translate it later. I'll translate it in English. Second chapter, paragraph 10. If you saw the Torah, HaKadosh Baruch Hu makir amitei ve'yedeya eiso kimei shihi ve'yedeya b'deyo shechutz mimeno kimei shehonu yoidi she'in onu v'daiteinu echot avol ha'beru nizbo ha'shmei hu v'daitei v'chayo v'echot mikol tzad mikol pino she'umolei ho'ya chay b'chayi ב'ידיה ב'דיה זו היו שם אלונס הרבה הוא וחיו וגייטה ואין הדובר כן אלו אחד הוא מכל צעד ופינו בכל דרך ניחות נמצא סמר הוא הידיה והוא הידוע והוא הדיה עצמו הכי רחוק הכי רחוק ודובר זה אין קיר בפלו עומרי ולאי בעזר ושומי ולא בלב אדם להכיר על בוריי. ולפי כך אמרים חי פרי וחי נפשכו. ואין אמרים חי עד השם, אלא חי עד השם. שאין אבירי וחי עוד שתיים, כמי חי הגופיס החיים וכחי המלאכו. I'll just read translation in English. It would not help much. HaKadosh Baruch Hu knows his true being and knows it as it is, not with a knowledge extraneous to himself, as is our knowledge. For our knowledge and ourselves, our knowledge and ourselves are separate. But as for the Creator, Baruch Hu, his knowledge and his life are one, in all aspects, from every point of view, and however we conceive unity. If the Creator lived, and his knowledge, I'm a mythic service, and his knowledge, if his life and his knowledge were extraneous to him, there would be a plurality of deities, namely he himself, his life and his knowledge. This, however, is not so. He is one in every aspect, from every angle, and in all ways, in all ways in which unity is conceived. Hence the conclusion that God is the one, the conclusion is, this is the most important conclusion, it's the relevant conclusion to our lecture, that God is one who knows, he is the one who is known, and he is knowledge itself. I'm repeating it. God is the one who knows, he is the one who is known, and he is knowledge for himself, of himself. All these being one. Scripture accordingly says by the life of Pharaoh, by the life of this, of my soul, of thy soul, but not by the life of the Almighty. The phrase employed by Scripture is as God liveth, because the Creator and his life are not dual, as is the case with the life of living bodies or separate intelligences. Do you understand it? Interesting is that Atanya, the founder of Chabad, who not too often quotes the Rambam, quotes that passage and says, "Val ze iskimnu kol chachmei Kabbalah." And all Kabbalists are in full agreement with that passage. So you have a Hechsher too. I cannot explain the whole passage, but the basic idea, I want to isolate. So the idea is the lodestar for us in our address tonight. What Maimonides is trying to say is as follows. The Gramma'al, I'll first, I mean, formulate it in the first sentence, and I'll explain the sentence. The grammatical relation between subject and object, or rather the grammatical split, division of subject into subject and object, is not applicable as far as the Almighty is concerned. Because this relation, this grammatical relation schism, if employed vis-à-vis God, would contradict the principle of his absolute unity. Let me explain it. Any logical judgment or grammatical sentence, I mean, let us speak rather in terms of logical judgment. Any logical judgment presupposes a subject, I mean a subject knower, who knows, or tries, or makes an attempt to gain knowledge of an object. But let us say, subject knower, and an object to be known. You cannot have any logical judgment or proposition without presupposing a subject knower, or who quests for knowledge, who sits in judgment, and an object to be known by the subject. Always, when I engage in a cognitive act, or I try to form, to make a logical judgment, so I always come across something which stands opposite me. For instance, I want to say, this is a mic. So the mic is the object, I am the subject. The mic is not a part of me. I confront the mic, or the mic rather confronts me, with a great deal of arrogance. And the object is very seldom respectful, polite, and defies me. Of course, it's a certain state of defiance between object-subject. Don't forget, I mean, the Latin word objector means disapproval, more or less. And I have to probe into the object and find something out about its nature, its behavioral patterns, and so forth. Any cognitive gesture is related to the outside, to an alien object, to something extraneous, When I say, for instance, the table is painted in brown or black, I am the subject knower, the one who performs the act of cognition, directed toward an object which is not a part of the I, who acts as the knower, is outside of me. Of course, while vis-à-vis judgment about the external world, the grammatical logical division of subject-object is self-evident, the situation changes when we turn from the knowledge of things and events outside of ourselves to self-knowledge. What about self-knowledge? For instance, when I say my eyesight is very poor, it happens to be a true statement. What do I accomplish by it? Immediately I remove myself from my optical organ called I. I am the knower, I am the subject, who renders judgment about an object which lost its identity with me. I am the knower. The I is the object to be known. So the very moment I say my eyesight is poor or good, is the eyesight is objectified. I is objectified. It has been severed from me. I mean epistemologically, logically severed, separated from me. It's not a part of the knower, because the knower and the known can never merge. There's always a gap, a chasm, separating the knower from the known. Even though the eye, physically, is a very important organ of my body. Whenever I predicate something of any part of my physical self, that part is immediately objectified, and if I may use a picturesque language, it secedes abruptly, or separates itself abruptly from me, and turns into a thing. Which I, the judgment maker, confront as an object. I can, it is self-evident, objectify my whole body. Little by little I lose all my organs. I can say something about my hands, I can say something about my legs, all right, it means immediate amputation. And I can say something about my gastrointestinal tract, about my heart, about my brains. I can objectify the whole body. By saying my body is strong or weak, I, a subject knower, separate myself from my body, which has been identified with me. The body becomes an object of my inquiry. As an object of my inquiry, it's not a part of myself. The process of knowing presupposes, there is no exception to the rule, alienation of the object from the subject. And it is self-evident that the logical judgment related to self-knowledge may encompass my whole personality. Body and soul, my I awareness. I can predicate something of my I awareness. I may state, for instance, I live, or I am sad, or I rejoice. I may make the famous statement by Descartes, cogito, I do some thinking. What happens when I make that statement? Immediately in such a case, the knower, the one who formulates the judgment, estranges himself from the eye who does the thinking, or from the melancholy eye who is overcome by grief and sadness, or from the enthusiastic eye who is intoxicated to his ecstasy. There is always, there is I, when I say I am thinking, so the I who says so is not the I who does the thinking, grammatically. Because I say something about myself. The very moment I say something about myself, myself is objectified and removed and severed from me. It's pretty stormy area. Of course, when I say I exist, there is total separation of I object that exists in accordance with my predication, and I think, I object, there is total separation of I object or I think, who exists from the I who made that statement or performed that cognitive act. The I subject is the judge who judges, explores, confronts in the mood of defiance the self objectified I. When I say I see myself, so the I who sees is not myself which is seen. We see. The I knower renders a judgment about I object which is outside of the I subject. Fundamentally, what does it mean? Fundamentally, there is no genuine self-knowledge. Because cognition is always an encounter between the I and the non-I. And when I try to engage in self-knowledge, the judgment which I form will be related not to the I who engages in self-knowledge, but to a non-I about whom I make certain statements or judgments. Always there is no self-knowledge in the full sense of the word. A subject-object confrontation in each logical performance is inevitable. Whatever I know about myself belongs to a self who severed his bonds with me and has estranged himself. To a self who stands opposite me, looking me into the face, and say, I am I object, you are I subject. Of course, I mean, if you want to take it, please take it. If you don't want, I don't care if you reject it. However, this is basic in classical logic, in medieval logic. This estrangement of the I subject from the I object. Of course, with regard to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that grammatical rule, that division, that every act of self-cognition precipitates, namely that self-cognition splits the personality into an object and a subject, into an object to be known and into a subject, into an object to be known, into a subject who gains knowledge, who probes, cannot be applied to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That grammatical rule Hoe die verpleiter gesproken would contradict his unity as well as omniscience. In HaKadosh Baruch Hu, this is according to the Rambam, this was the greatest mystery. There is no knowledge. Knowledge does not divide. There is no division into subject-object. HaKadosh Baruch Hu knows himself as a subject, not as an object. Division would contradict Ardus Abere. Shehilo, where Yedeya Bebeyo Shechutz Memenu, if HaKadosh Baruch knew himself as extraneous, as somebody extraneous to himself, Hoye Shomer Lo Nisharbe, would Rachmon Ritzlar be many deities. Elo Hu HaYedeya, he is the knower, V'hu HaYadua, who is the knower? I subject. Who is HaYadua? I object to be known. V'hu HaDeya Be'atzo. That's what my mind says. HaKadosh Baruch Hu's self-knowledge is truly self-knowledge, while our self-knowledge is an illusion. We don't know ourselves. We know somebody who separated himself from ourselves. But that's what the Rambam says, that the human mind cannot comprehend it at all. Now, let me continue. The duality as presented now, before, is of course is a philological nature, epistemological nature. This estrangement and alienation of the object from the subject is formal and can only be understood in terms of logic and grammar, logic and epistemology. However, Yehudus was of the opinion that that duality is not only of grammatical and epistemological nature. It is more than that. It is an experiential duality as well. I subject and I object is not only a grammatical split, not only an abstract division, not only an epistemological, so to say, analysis. It's not only related to epistemological analysis. It is a reality. Man is divided into I subject and into I object. Whatever is true in grammar and logic and epistemology turns into an ontology of man, into a metaphysique of man. And that division in man, that duality of I subject and I object influences human behavior, his ethics and emotional life, his political philosophy, and becomes actually the guiding force as far as human development of human history is concerned. Let us analyze this duality at a metaphysical as well psychological level. It's still a bit stormy about it. Man belongs, and that is the story of creation in the first chapter confirms it, man is a cosmic being. He belongs to the objective order. He is enmeshed in the scheme of things and events. This awareness that I am a part of the cosmos, I am united with my environment, with nature, with the astral world. I am within a certain system. This awareness embraces body as well as soul. Everything in man solidifies into a concrete, tangible, here and now reality. Man, by gazing at himself tell of the flux or the ever-changing morphe into thinghood. He experiences himself as an object, as I would say an objective being, as a thing, as a thing. Man is basically engages in outgoing toward an order which is outside of him. He equates himself with the world of sensible things. Man, object, is bent on receiving messages through his senses from an external world. And the content of those impressions and messages, classified and interpreted with the help of his nervous system and intellect, is the élan vital of his existential experience. What does man, the man thinks of himself? He doesn't think of his inwardness. Oh no. There is no much introspection. He doesn't think of himself, of his inner core of being. He thinks of himself in relation to the outside world, in relation to his friends, to his family members of his household, in relation to his political career, in relation to disease, in relation to certain forces rampant in the world. He is afraid of external things, of things which are outside of him. His content, the content of his consciousness, of his awareness, consists exclusively of messages he received from the outside world. Messages transmitted to him through his nervous system. Optical messages, acoustic messages, and so forth and so on. But the content of his awareness consists exclusively of those messages which were conveyed to him by his environment. The very substance of his awareness consists of the outside impressions bettering upon his gait. And let me now say about the reality of man object. Man object is a thing, and his reality, to give you a bit epistemological, his reality is also that of a thing. I'm speaking about man object. If you say a thing exists, a table exists, so basically there are two distinctive traits which mark the order of existence, the existential order of thinghood. One, openness due to vacuity. Second, responsiveness within the system. Things are observable. Its essence, the essence of a thing, of the table, of the lamp, of the mic, of this cup, of this can, the essence of a thing is always exposed, either to the naked eye or to some sophisticated instrument, precision instrument. The object, whatever belongs into the objective order, lies open to the observer, who is the subject. There is no hiding, no disguise for the thing. A thing cannot hide. You understand very well. For why can't a thing hide? Why couldn't the table hide? What do you say? For it lacks the place where to hide. Why does it lack the place where to hide? Because it lacks the inward dimension. There is no inwardness to a thing. There is always outwardness, externality. There is no inwardness to a thing. There is no depth. The thing exists only at the surface, at its surface. There is no existential center. There is no inner core. There is only a crust of reality. The crust is there. There is no core to the thing. I mean, physically you can speak about the core. But metaphysically you cannot speak about inner core. What is the thing? Just an aggregate of many little things. There is no unity, there is no center. A thing contains an X number, I'll reinterpret it in psychological terms, pertaining to man. Don't get discouraged. There is no unity, there is no centrality. It consists of an X number of planes, almost an infinite number of planes, and each plane, a plane is simple, a surface is simple. It is the product of multiplication, of two dimensions. Let me add the following. When I say that a thing is open, that a thing is knowable, everything is knowable. The outskirts of the cosmos, the flying nebula, are knowable. I don't mean to say, I'm speaking from metaphysical, epistemological viewpoint. I don't mean to say that technically everything is observable and knowable. A thing technically it may cause a lot of trouble to the researcher. Nature at times codes its messages in a puzzling manner. It may take centuries, even millennia, to break the code and to comprehend the symbols. However, metaphysically, epistemologically, there is not a single streak of paradoxality or irrationality which would rule out comprehensibility of the world of thinghood. As I have emphasized before, the thing cannot hide, for it has no hiding place. The surface existence is exposed to the public. There is no ontological privacy to the thing. It's open and public. This is number one. This is one distinctive mark of existence of things. And of course, in contradistinction and contrast to the existence of man. The existence is open. You know why it is open? Because it's a vacuous existence. There is no inwardness. There is no depth. There is no core. If there is no core, it's open, it's exposed to view, to observation. Then there is something else important. And you realize the significance of those statements, even that big boring, when you translate them in the metaphysical terms into psychological terms. Then there is something else characteristic of the about the existence of a thing, of an object. The reality of a thing is always identical with interrelatedness. There are no lonely things. There are mighty lonely men, yes, but there are no lonely things in this world. Things exist within systems. Each thing is a prisoner of an order of thinghood. It can never liberate itself from that captivity, for liberation would spell doom and extinction. The thing does not exist as a single thing. All things exist within an all-inclusive order, namely the cosmic drama. They exist as parts of a system. They exist only relationally, not per se. Within the system, they respond to stimulation, certain events provoke action and involve the thing in the dynamics of the system. There is no initiative to the thing, there is no drive. There is a system of matter and energy which precipitates quite often reaction, hyphenated, not one word, reaction, but rather a reactivity on the part of the single thing. Hence, the reality of singhood is manifested through its responsiveness to the system. For instance, I say the table exists. How does the existence of that table express itself? First, because it's extended to space. It occupies space. If the table didn't occupy any space, it wouldn't exist. You will agree with me? Yeah. If the table exists, apparently the table occupies space. What does it mean, the table occupies space? It is not a table in isolation, but one within the coordinate system called space. It exists because it is interrelated within the system, within another system, the gravitational field. It exists because it exerts pressure on my nerves. My optic nerve is stimulated by the table reflecting light, and so forth and so on. The existence, the two distinctive traits of existence, of thinghood, express themselves first in openness due to vacuity, I'm repeating. Vacuity means emptiness, no absence of inwardness, of a central core, of dimension of depth. Number one. Number two, their existence is characterized and be characterized by interrelatedness. They don't exist as individuals, they don't exist as single things, they exist as parts of a very powerful and all-inclusive system. This is the system of things. Interestingly, is the Mama Chazal, the Gemara Menoches, Behiborom, Eile Tovot Hashamayim Vooretz, Behiborom. So Chazal say, Behiborom, heaven and earth were created with the letter He. Why the letter He was chosen is for, I mean, the answer is a twofold one. First of all, the letter He, the sound He, is a guttural sound, you know very well. And it's nothing else but exhaling a breath. So it means they were born, the world came into existence when HaKadosh Baruch Hu exhaled his breath. It means there was no effort, there was no performance, just the breath of HaKadosh Baruch Hu summoned the world into existence. In Akdomas we say, Ugoose Kalile the Lesba Mamoshe. It is a light letter, and by light, which is not concrete at all. He called the world into existence. But He has another aspect. What is He, if not a surface surrounded, bounded on three sides? It's a plane. Bounded at three sides. There is no hidden essence to the He besides its mathematical measurements. Length multiplied by width. That's all. That's all that the He contains. Reality, what did Chazal mean by saying the He Nivru? That the world of thinghood, the world of object, has just a surface existence like the He. It's a quantitative existence, the world is of a numerical quantitative nature, there is no quality to it, no content. What is a plane? A geometric area, the product of simple multiplication. The plane, the hay, conceals nothing, contains no enigma or paradox, has no depth. It is as simple as the mind of a child who studies arithmetic or the table of multiplication. Now let us get back to men's things. We spoke about things. But we are not interested in things, we are interested in men. In light of this analysis, man thing is a selfish being, without content, without an inner core. His ontological awareness, as his I consciousness, his existential experience, is at best, if he has such an experience, if he has such an awareness, but at best, it is very tenuous, slim, tender, thick. There is no thickness, no centrality, no focus to his existential experience. The latter is plain, open, and vacuous. For instance, I come across quite often a very strange phenomenon in modern society, not only modern society, modern literature, so forth and on. But when I say modern, I don't mean the literature, or the press, or the periodicals of our generation. When I say modern, or maybe you see in retrospect, I mean, the whole 19th century, or even the latter half the 20th century, and perhaps half of the 19th century, excuse me. There is a certain openness to modern man. There is no modesty to him. Modern men may discuss intimate phases of his life in public or with his friends. Somehow he's not embarrassed to pick up subjects or to discuss topics or problems which belong into the realm of the private, intimate, clandestine life of man. Modern man lacks sneers, he lacks modesty. You know why he lacks modesty? is man thing. He considers himself, he experiences himself as a thing, as an object, as something concrete. As man thing, he has no inwardness. He consists of an X number of planes. If everything's on the surface, there is no secrets. There is no privacy. There are no intimate phases in one's life. And that's why we are speaking about the curse of pornography. Not so much, there has been pornography since man was created. I mean, pornography is not an American phenomenon, it's not American Congress, not the first one, I mean, to introduce a bill to prohibit pornography. For me, pornography is as old as man himself is, because man has a dead imagination sometimes. But what is unique about modern pornography is that the legislators want to legalize it. And there are tremendous forces, powerful forces of it, rampant in society, which would like to see pornography liberalized. And of course, prohibition against pornographic literature, according to their view, is in conflict with the... Which amendment is it? Huh? I beg your pardon? Which amendment is it? Free speech? Why is it? Is it because modern man experiences himself as man thing, as man object? As man object, he absolutely is open and vacuous. He leads an open existence, geared to tasks and notions of society. Actually, modern man, man thing, man object, experiences himself as a worker. as a producer of goods, as someone who is duty-bound, who was born for one task alone, to contribute his share to society. And modern man thing is evaluated in terms of his accomplishment. In accordance with his contribution toward the welfare of society, there is no other criterion, because his existence consists in two things. Is rather characterized by two distinctive traits. One, openness, vacuity, the lack of inwardness, complete absence of depth. Second, interrelatedness, being within a system, being a part of something. There is no isolation to the world of things. There is no other criterion by which we could weigh the existential worth of individual besides work. The latter is a worker, is a producer, or the normal one. His existence exhausts itself in enriching society, in producing goods. Of course, the more goods he produces, the more diligent a worker is, the more involved he is in the dynamics of society, the more visible he is, the more conspicuous he is. And since his existence consists in being open, observable, conspicuous, so the greater his accomplishments are, the worthier and the weightier he is, the more valuable he is. And we understand, I mean, from that viewpoint, from viewpoint man-object, as an experience, as an experiential reality, man sees himself as a thing, as an object. We understand the whole Marxist myth of productive man. Man who is not productive forfeits his dignity. And productive man in Marxism means simply man is supposed to produce material goods in order to enrich society. The whole viewpoint of Marxism, the whole philosophical anthropology of Marxism, is that of man thing, of man object, of man being just a producer of goods. Man externalizing himself, objectifying himself, going out toward the order, toward the system, being a part of the system. Man, who is interrelated with others, and whose existence is just a crust, not an inner core. In this context, man thing, and basically, I want to add, if you will analyze a person, now, I mean, I'm not a psychiatrist, not a psychologist, and certainly not an analyst, but if you will talk to a person now, you'll find out that the content of his awareness consists exclusively, as I told you before, of impressions he receives from the outer world. There is no introspection, there is no self-knowledge, I would say man is not a creator of ideas anymore. He receives messages from the world. And of course, with the help of his nervous system and his intellect, I mean, somehow he classifies the messages and applies the knowledge he receives from the world, I mean, in order to make his position firmer and to produce a higher quality of good. But his awareness consists not of ideas created by his mind. His awareness is on the receiving end. it's not productive anymore. He proceeds, then changes it, changes the ideas, but he's just a recipient. He's not a giver anymore. In this context, the individual is completely forgotten. Men think, the thing does not exist alone, and if it does exist, no one is concerned with its existence. His dignity and worth are gone, for he does not exist per se, but as a contributing member of a system, of a society, race or class. Whatever is visible, whatever is noticeable, through the medium of accomplishments, whatever registers, is registered in statistical tables, is worthwhile, and is teleologically justified. Whatever is hidden, closed, whatever is intangible, is non-existent. In other words, the individual's submission to society is a foregone conclusion if man looks upon himself as a thing, as an object. Of course, let's not fool ourselves. Modern man does not believe in his soul at all. Modern man looks upon himself only as a body, actually. This eye awareness is awareness of a physique, not of a spiritual reality. Of course, as a body, he belongs into the world of things. To exist is identical with the verb to work. As a matter of fact, let us not fool ourselves. Political sovereignty is nurtured by the idea of man object, of man thing. Whose ontic legitimacy is inherent not in him, but in his usefulness to a system. There is no individual independence within a state. And let's not fool ourselves. This applies not only to the corporate state. Certainly the corporate state, I don't have to explain to you. But even the most advanced political democracies, which have guaranteed human freedom, many freedoms of man is looked upon as a man thing. The interests of the individual are always subordinated to those of the system, of society. All privileges, all freedoms, all rights and prerogatives are subject to suspension in times of emergency. There isn't a single democracy on earth. There has never been a single democracy in history, in human annals, which did not suspend human freedoms or human rights during times of crisis, of emergency. Why? Because the state, the system, it is summum bonum, and everything else is irrelevant if the summum bonum, the state, is endangered. What I want to show you is that man thing is not a figment of my fantasy. It is a reality. Man object, I think. Man reduces himself to thinghood. And this perhaps lies at the root of our modern troubles and of modern crisis of the human being. The human being has reduced himself to a thing. A clever thing. You see it in colloquial English, a clever thing. I could never understand how can a thing be clever. But if man is a thing, then man is clever. The thing is clever. A clever thing, intelligent thing, inventive thing, technologically very skillful, aggressive thing. Yes, but just a thing. And apparently, man is not satisfied with being a thing. He wants to be something else. There are no words in the vocabulary. Somebody else, not just a thing. And perhaps the confusion, the complexity in this modern world is due partly to the identification of modern man with the order of thinghood, with an existence which expresses itself in a world, in vacuity and in openness, in emptiness and in desolation, in existence which is reduced to material success, to a home, to a garage, to 5 cars, to 2 cars, to jewelry, to paintings. This is the existence of a thing. It's a vacuous existence. Apparently, modern man is not satisfied. He wants to be something else than just a thing. Of course, the Greek theory of conceptual universalism, that the class exists, the individual is just a shadow, is non-existent, is typical of the man-thing ontology. The telos of man-thing is not to be found in him, but outside of him in the system. And perhaps that's exactly what some people today, young or old, people are confused or perplexed, object to. They want the telos, the goal, the existential goal of man, to be found within him, not outside of him. Now let me give you several characteristics of man-thing. Man-thing, since his very existential experience, is not an individual one, but is rather interwoven into the fabric of a system or society, does not exercise too much individual freedom. I'm not talking about political freedom, about the franchise to vote or to elect a president, but about metaphysical ethical freedom. His thinking, I mean of the thinking of man thing, is acting, and perhaps there is no acting of man things, it's perhaps only reacting like a thing. His thinking, acting, reacting follow definitive collective patterns, designs that have been approved by the system, by society. Man thing belongs to an establishment. No matter how discredited the word establishment is nowadays, we still belong. Man things belong to an establishment. He accepts everything that is in the vogue. The judgments and values are not his, not unique. They belong to an all-embracing system, to the establishment. Man-thing is not a revolutionary. He believes in progress, yes, of course. It's a matter of word, it's a good word. In slow, gradual, evolutionary processes. It may take a millennium, but man-thing is sure that the human society is progressing. Man-thing is fair, very fair. Modern man is a fair person, but not kind. Man thing doesn't know what kindness is. He is honest, I mean, except criminals, of course, but not compassionate. He cherishes justice, but knows very little of love, what love is. He will help his fellow man, without sharing inwardly, the travail and suffering and misery of the unfortunate person to whom he extends help and aid. His very being is outward oriented. He sees just the crust of reality. He never tries to penetrate into the inner core of reality. He is a man who is not curious to find out what is behind the veil. He is boundary conscious and very precise. He knows and he has understanding for detail, because he's an executive. He knows nothing, but he knows nothing of the innumerable worlds of individual conception. His concern is just one world, namely the world of singhood. Yetzirah le'ilam hazeh. Shtei yetziras. One yetzirah le'ilam hazeh. What does it mean that God created man for this world? This is the way God willed man. God willed man to look upon himself as a thing and to feel himself a part of that natural cosmic order and feel his rootedness in the soil of that, of this world. However, this is more or less the portrait of the image which I try to project of man thing. Man thing as a reality, as an existential experience. Now, but my mind has spoke another person, of man subject. I subject, not I object. Second, there is another experiential experience. Man is also, he is a thing, he is concrete. You can touch him, you can see him, you can talk to him, you can communicate with him. He is a reality. He is vacuous and empty. But he is capable of wise. He is a producer, he is a manufacturer, he is an executive. He climbs to the moon. But no matter where you land, you will just be a part of a system, of a system of thinghood. But man is also an intangible figure, remote from the scheme of thinghood and phenomenal reality. Yes, man is an intangible figure, man subject. Yes, he is present in the world of thinghood, however, at the same time, not completely belonging to it, revealing something which is not part of this world of facticity. He is entangled among things, in events, but nevertheless, he feels from time to time a stranger, who is lonesome for his real home. Man somehow transcends his own concreteness and thinghood to the point of finding himself in the embrace of another reality. And that reality is an I subject. It is a reality which cannot be defined. It's not a thing. There is no concreteness. The I is not something anymore. It's not concrete, it's not a concrete reality, possessing gravity, stimulating the optical or ductile nerves. He is the subject that Ram spoke of, subject knower, who is inseparable from man thing. But there is something in man which can never be caught in the crucible of objectification. He can never be, this something can never be converted into objectivity, into a thing. Interesting is the Ramban in Breshis. I cannot explain everything in Ramban. Vayipa ba'ap of Nishmas Ruach Hayim, says the Ramban, Hu Ruach Hashem Agodel, this is the breath of the Almighty, Mipiv Dasit Vuno, out of his mouth we learn wisdom and intelligence. Ki anefeach, whoever blows a breath into the nostrils of somebody, Mimishmosu Yitimbei, he gives the person a part of his breath.
And that's what is stated in Sifri. Nedorim, whoever takes a vow, ki nishba b'chayamor, is likened to one who swore by the life of the king. Shavuos, whoever takes an oath, ki nishba b'melech atzmei, is equal to one who swears by the king himself. Af al pi sheirai v'davor, zecha v'davor, Chaya b'shem v'chei napshecha. I cannot explain the whole Ramban, but Ramban says something very strange. That in the pasuk of Ayipa Bapa Pishmas Ruachayim, we find an allusion to Nedorim and Shmuz. To Nedorim and Shmuz, you know, but Neder is a Shmuz. You know what Ramban means? I cannot explain it in detail. You know very well that neder is a yisur chefze. Neder applies to men think, to men object. Shvuos is a yisur gavre. Shvuos is applicable to men subject, to I subject. This is chaya v'shem v'chei napshecha. It's exactly what the Rambam has said. That God created man as a dual being, as an object and as a subject. As a thing, as an intangible personality. And in Alocha, that vision asserts itself, whoever knows a little bit of Nedorim Shmuz, in the distinction between Neder and Shmuz. At this juncture, we are confronted with men's subject, whose existence already is centered, man persona. Man is not open anymore. He is clandestine. He is elusive. Man is not a member of an establishment. He is an individual. There is no more existential boredom. Gone is the uniformity and monotony of being, to which the order of thinghood is exposed. The existence of man's subject is already unbounded, not like a surface, unchartered. It is intangible and it is mysterious. Man's subject is a mystery. Man's object is an open book. Man's subject is a mystery. You know why is a mystery? You know why man's subject is a mystery? Why? For a simple reason. Because there is inwardness to him. He can hide himself. He can disguise himself. He is not exposed to the inquiring eye. And it is, and we read in Bereishis, וישחבי אודם וחבו אישתי מפני עדי שם רגים ויקרו עדי שם רגים על אודם ויים עלי היקו. And man and his wife Eve hid themselves before the Almighty, and God called them unto man and said unto him, where art thou? Didn't God, the omniscient, omnipotent Lord of the universe, know where Adam and Eve were? Rashi asked this question. Rashi answers, Yedea. He knew. So if he knew, why did he ask? But this is not, the question was not actually, the question was not on behalf of himself. This is the question God asked man, the Almighty asked man, the father of mankind, Ayeko, on behalf of countless future generations, on behalf of the millennia and centuries of anticipated human history, where are thou? Who are you? And who are you? And if one says to himself, because not only Pip is unknown, is a mystery to the Tao, to his fellow man. He's a mystery to himself. If man addresses himself, that is in confusion and marvel. And said I echo, where are they? He just echoes the words of the Almighty at the dawn of creation and human history. Western civilization forgot the Ayeko. Let itself be deceived by men think and forgot to ask Ayeko. Had reached the brink of an abyss. Quite noteworthy is the second minor of Chazal, that the world Elam Abor was created with the letter Yud. Elam Azeh with the letter He. Elam Abor with the letter Yud. The Yud, I don't know, if there are mathematicians in the hall, should simply not listen to me now. That I'm going to speak might be pure ignorance, sheer ignorance. But anyway, I've checked with classical medieval mathematics, in particular with medieval philosophy. It is, whatever I'll say is correct, whether it is true now, in modern mathematics, I tried to check. I didn't get a clear answer. Mathematicians in the hall should tell me if I'm wrong, I'll shut up. The Yud is dimensionless. The single point per se does not represent anything. It lacks thinghood. It lacks reality. And it certainly lacks concreteness. However, the point, even though per se is something very elusive, is the origin, that's what medieval mathematicians thought, of all geometric figures. Because only, that's exactly what they said, I'm afraid to say it on my own behalf, that's exactly what they said, only by moving the point, the line emerges. And again, by moving the line, the plane appears, is born. To deny the existence of the point, even though the point is intangible, dimensionless, imperceptible, unobservable, to deny the existence of the point would be tantamount, according to the mathematicians of antiquity, as well as the Middle Ages, to the destruction of the geometric world. Certainly, the point cannot be explained, cannot be described, cannot be measured. It is not a thing at all. It is not a thing at all. Yet, what the Kabbalists used to call the point, it is the Archei, the origin. It is the Makor, the Bereshis of everything. Per se, it's not a thing. And he is the Makor, the Bereshis, the origin, the Archei of everything. The point in itself is not perceptible nor considerable. Yet, without the point, you cannot imagine the geometric world. The Kabbalists call the point Nekude Kadmoe, the less machshavtet hisodei, the Archei, the origin that the human mind is not able to place into a certain frame of reference or a certain frame of thinghood. The discursive thinking of man has no categories to accommodate something dimensionless or something which is nothing. And yet, again I repeat, this nothing, this unreality, is the arche of reality. Whoever knows a little bit about Kabbalah will understand what I'm referring to. And the human I subject, the human personality, is like the point. Has it any dimension? I subject? No. I think has dimensions. Like a surface. I subject has no dimension. Is it perceptible? No. Chazal said, Reyo Vine Nero, about Neshama. Is it observable? No. Is it real? I'll ask you what you understand by reality. If you understand by reality something which is interrelated within a system, something observable, something which stimulates my optical nerve, something which stimulates my tactile nerve, my acoustic nerve, something which I can touch, something which is extended in space, something which is included in a coordinate system, I'll answer you no, no, no. If you want to say it's unreal, I don't care. But without the I subject, you cannot imagine the I object. Think of man, is unimaginable if behind every man thing, man object, I subject, is not living. Now, with the change of the metaphysique of man, it is the change from an awareness of oneself, which asserts itself in concrete symbols. I exist because I move my fingers. I exist because I touch my hand. I exist because I feel my forehead. I exist because I take my pulse. I exist because I have pain. I exist because I can walk, because I can rise, I can stand up, I can lie down, I can do exercise, and so forth on. I mean, this is the awareness of man thing. What is the awareness of man subject? It's hard to describe. Mostly this awareness asserts itself in a certain feeling of estrangement and alienation of man's subject from society and from this world. In the quest of man for something unknown to him, in his longing, in his yearning for something more beautiful, something more exalted, something more sublime, man thing doesn't quest. Man thing doesn't care for the impossible. He's very realistic. He's very precise. He doesn't behold visions. Man's subject beholds visions. Let us take a look into the descriptive psychology of man's subject. The psychological image that man's subject projects is completely different from the image of man object or man thing. In fact, it is the very antithesis of what objectified man stands for. Man subject has inwardness. There is an existential inner core to him. He is not satisfied just with surface existence, with vacuous reality. He thinks primarily in pictures, beholds beautiful visions. He is original, unique to the extent of being misunderstood. He defies stereotypes, cliches, and sometimes sacrosanct institutions if his sensitive soul discovers hypocrisy in such institutions. Or in society, more cliches, more grandiloquence is tolerated, is frank to the point of being discourteous. His feelings are deep-seated, not like the emotional life of men think, which has no roots, floats on the surface. Neither his sadness, nor his joy, nor his hatred, nor his love of men think means anything. Today a friend, tomorrow an enemy. What does the Irish politician say? Be aware of your friends, because they are the enemies of tomorrow. That is characteristic of man abject, but not of man subject. This characteristic of man, whose symbol is the head, but of man whose symbol is the dimensionless point, that man has a different emotional life, deep-seated, consuming, at times violent and overwhelming. The idea is everything. The word is of no significance. To the man things, with regard to man things, the opposite is true. The idea is nothing. The word is important. Men subject, the I subject, is not always fair, because men subject sometimes displays extremism, and even fanaticism. Men think is not a fanatic, is not an extremist. Is not always fair, but many a time compassionate. He shares in the distress of his fellow man. He's not always just. He can be very unjust. Just the opposite of men think, but often seized by a great love and kindness. His spiritual perception, unlike men think, who slowly, gradually builds up his sensations, his impressions, man, his spiritual perception of man subject is abrupt, soaring aloft. He lacks precision, contrary to men think. And contrary to men think, he does not handle well, cannot employ the method of induction. Induction is not his forte. However, he's a genius in postulating, in envisioning the artistic big stroke performance. He lacks perceptivity for the detail, for the minutiae. He is impatient as far as detail is concerned. However, he is very sensitive to the grandeur of the whole, to the configuration, the beautiful sweeping curves and straight lines ending in infinity. He sees everything contrary to men think. Men subject sees everything not in its total design. Man's subject projects the outline, the grand conception. Man thing fills in, as far as detail is concerned. Man thing is sedate, self-righteous, limited in his claims, can distinguish between the possible and impossible. Man's subject is visionary and quite often confuses the real with the unreal, the fantastic with the practical. But the main distinction between man's subject and man's object is concerns their logic. The logic of men object, of men think, if I may say so, somebody logician will come, will be here, will indict me, is an inductive one. It's an empirical logic. And the purpose of the logic, I mean the task of the logic of men think, is to guard him from practical blunders leading to defeat. Men's subject, the logic of men's subject, is a different one completely. He takes advice not from an empirical logic, but from an a priori logic, a priori postulated logic, which protects him not from practical blunders. He makes plenty of blunders. Not from practical errors, but from something which may result in the loss of greatness. The a priori postulated logic is actually a logic of the pure will, of the pure non-practical will. A will which has reasons of its own and rules of its own. The highest authority for man object is reason. The highest authority for man subject is the will. Man object is a reasonable being, is a rational being. Man subject is a voluntaristic being. He is driven by a primordial will. The will has its own reasons, its own logic. And now, what is the attitude of your hearts for those two personae who abide in every one of us? Judaism has accepted both images of man. Judaism stated, man is both. It is true. He is a thing, he is a reality, he is a factum, he is an object.